Hi there. I'm Ari Lynette, and today I'll be trying my best to talk about eyeshadow palette designs and my experience with creating them. So ever since I started posting these palette designs in January of this year, can you believe, this has really opened me up to a lot of opportunities, and it's given me the pleasure of meeting so many new people. People who might be listening to this podcast right now, perhaps? So it felt like it made sense to make a full episode of this, talking about just about everything you might have wanted to know about my palette designs, but were too afraid to ask. And what's great is that some of my Instagram friends and followers were not too afraid to ask questions about my palette designs. So one whole section of this episode, which is more like half the episode, judging by my notes, is just going to be me answering those questions. Just the things that people wanted to know about the designs. But I also want to get into how I started doing the designs, why I started doing the designs, and all the little nuggets of wisdom I've picked up along the way, and why I think that anybody who likes eyeshadow should try palette designing at least once. The short answer, because it's really fun. That's why. So before I get into the episode, it's disclaimer corner time, I'd like to put up three quick notes. First of all, thank you so much to everyone who listened to the first episode, and has just been supporting this podcast overall. I know it might not be everyone's thing, and I definitely went into this process with the knowledge that it wouldn't, but I never want to only do things that will get attention or likes. I want to do things that are personally fulfilling, regardless of the marketability or whether it'll do well in analytics. This is definitely a real passion project for me. Another thing is that the audio on this podcast might be a little off at times, particularly like how the volume of the intro music might compare to the volume of me talking right now. This is going to have to be a work in progress, and over time I'll hopefully be able to fix some of those issues, like the odd transitions between dialogue and music. Fingers crossed those should be sorted somewhere down that line. But be patient. I'm not currently very familiar with Anchor's interface, but I will be soon enough, that much I can say. Also, my talking speed, my sister actually brought this up, but my talking speed is something I'll be trying to refine over the course of this podcast. It is, again, very much a work in progress, and I think if you listen to the trailer I posted for the podcast, you'll know that one of my goals is to try and just talk better. So that'll include going through my thoughts at a more suitable speed. Work in progress, people. And then the last thing I want to clarify before we start is that this title, it's just a title. It's not guaranteed to be accurate. I really don't want to come across on here or ever as this be-all, end-all for palette designs, because first of all, that's not true whether I wanted it to be or not. And secondly, I think that doing something like this should always have a bit of you put into it. Like, everyone's going to have a different experience, different approaches, and some things I just don't have all the knowledge on in the world about. I can try and be as inclusive as possible with my designs and make sure they suit darker skin tones, but at the end of the day, only someone with dark skin can really tell me whether I achieved that. I can only try my best to make these palettes as successful, as inclusive, as engaging as possible, and quite often I'll post designs and I won't know how they'll perform. All I'm sure of is that they won't be horrendously offensive. So consider this a rough guide to everything I've learned about designing eyeshadow palettes so far. So, in last week's episode, I started off my deep dive into the shrieking madness of the film Cats by going over its origin story. And in today's episode, I will be going through, what do you know, another origin story, this time for my palette designs. Now, I can't say for certain that every single episode of this podcast will start with or even have an origin story section, but it just happens that both of the topics I went with first each have their own backstories, and it's probably all going to make a lot more sense if you get to know about the journey rather than just plonking you at the destination. So let's start with a big question. How exactly did I start doing palette designs? This is actually a question that I feel splits off into two and alludes to two different topics. When I started making the designs and when I started posting the designs on Instagram, I did talk about this briefly when I first featured as a guest on another podcast called Max and Ellie with a Side of Beauty, which, by the way, it's a great podcast. I love it to bits. I love being able to wind down at the end of the day and just listen to them talk about beauty. I really love it. I'd highly recommend their podcast. And it's also an Anchor podcast, so try Anchor. But when I went on there the first time, I talked about how I did these designs beforehand, and then I took them into the world of Instagram. And that's a true explanation, but it's also a very simple explanation of how it began. And I feel like this episode is a great opportunity to really just dive in, go even further, like consider this the deluxe edition with some exclusive Japanese bonus tracks. Like, we're going in really deep. So, I started doing palette mock-ups and full-on makeup mock-ups that were nothing to do with existing brands. I just did a lot of designs, and they were essentially, what if you had your own makeup line? And these were things I didn't show anyone, not my parents or my sister or anyone online or offline. These were just my own little explorations of what would you do? And I think that this was one of the first seeds of palette designing being a thing. This was like the alpha stage, and it was always just for me. It was always just this kind of wish fulfillment question, which still kind of carries through into the designs I post on Instagram. And I still have those little ideas for what if, but it's pretty much constantly in flux and changing because I've just become even more particular about what I'm aiming for, and I can't really settle on an idea until I end up going, no, I'm sick of this version of the line. I want to do it differently. So I think doing single product palette designs like the ones I post on Instagram is something that works really well for me, as it's a lot more contained. Because if I was designing like a whole line, it would probably be a bit of a nightmare, like in terms of people working with me, because I'd be so finicky about every little aspect, all of the branding and the cohesion and just everything. I don't know. Maybe one day I'll actually get something I can live with and find a way to make it a reality, but if that happened, it would be a long way off. Now, I want to talk about a channel that really inspired me to change the direction of my mockups and what I was designing. Because when I first saw the couple of videos that Makeup Struggles made about redesigning eyeshadow palettes, that really struck a chord with me. I feel like, especially recently, I've been taking such an issue with the mentality of the small beauty community when it comes to critiquing products and new releases. I'm not going to get too far into it on this episode because I'm planning a whole separate episode about that, and I've actually scripted most of it. But basically, I think that a lot of critique on new makeup releases is kind of shit, if I'm honest. I think there's this whole culture of like, this product is boring. Who asked for this? We already have this in our collections. And over a period of time, you just get so frustrated and just over it. But what I saw with these videos from Makeup Struggles, who was actively taking an eyeshadow palette that she thought, this doesn't work for what I want in a palette, and actually taking the time to redesign it and turn it around, like maybe they could have done something like this and people would like it more. That's something I just really admired. I really found it proactive, and I find that I want to see more channels go down that mindset rather than just bashing releases. Again, I'm not going to go into all my feelings about the small beauty community. That's another time. That's another time. Sadly, Makeup Struggles decided to move on from her YouTube channel, and I believe she put her videos on private, which I understand her reasoning for, though I think it's still sad. However, her videos did strike a chord with a lot of people, and I happen to be one of them. And what I saw was gradually more and more people doing videos that involved redesigning palettes, and this was something I was excited to see, and I still am excited to see it. It's some of my favorite beauty related content to this day, and I enjoy it because it's proactive and creative, and it's a great way for someone to see themselves not just as this kind of passive consumer of makeup, but someone who can mold it to suit them better. If you think a palette is boring or uncreative or unoriginal, maybe find a way to fix it and make it work for you. Nowadays, a lot of the palette redesigns I see are on Instagram, and I see some excellent stuff on there. I'm just like chef's kissing a ton of those redesigns. And long may that continue, because I love those. But wait a minute, you may ask. You don't really do a lot of palette redesigns on your Instagram. You do a lot more original designs and concepts. Why is that? And for that, you can blame my overstimulated brain. Because over the course of time, centuries passed, civilizations went up and went down, and eventually I went from the question of how could they do this differently to the question of what could they do instead? I wasn't as interested in redesigning eyeshadow palettes because at that point I changed my approach to critiquing releases. I felt a lot more at peace with the idea that not every new release would work for me on a creative level. And I kind of just didn't care about some releases. Tot's gonna Tot, Two-Faced's gonna Two-Faced. Like, I did still make some videos which were all about palette redesigns, and I really enjoyed those, and I loved how those redesigns turned out. But because I had this little seed of the what if from when I was doing my own concepts at first, I got a lot more interested in the idea of, well, if I was in charge of Two-Faced, I would take their product line in this direction. Like, I could use an existing foundation and structure of a chocolate bar palette or a naked palette or whatever that company was making at that time and gently nudge the brand into a more intriguing direction. And that wasn't something I saw a lot of at the time. And then I did. So the first time I ever saw original concept palettes for brands, because I certainly did not create this, and I didn't even see this first on Instagram, I saw it first on YouTube, and it was a video from LS, and she designed a couple of palettes for, I'm not sure which one of these videos came first, but it was either Urban Decay or Anastasia Beverly Hills. She did both of those videos. I can't remember which one was the first one she did, but I saw this video, and around this time, I had started doing some of my own concepts for existing brands in my own time, kind of just for me, like I did with the whole what if stuff. One of the earliest designs I posted on my Instagram was the Too Faced Dark Chocolate Bar. That was designed around this time, like around the time that that video went out, so long before I was posting them on Instagram. But her videos were a great indication of what a creator could do with their hobby by taking a product line that she liked, but giving it her own spin and injecting some of her creative vision. It also indicated to me that I wasn't just deluded. And yes, other people have had this idea too, and that is an awesome feeling. I love seeing other people doing the same obscure thing that I'm doing online. It's such a validating feeling because you have this little sense of parasocial camaraderie. Like, you have no idea who I am, but we both do something a bit different and I feel better about myself. Thank you. That's surprisingly potent. And I would be remiss to not talk about the other big inspiration for making custom palettes. And a few weeks ago, I would have told you it was Georgia Harris, but turns out it was actually Jordan Harris the whole time. And it was her custom palettes that really inspired me to try out my own palette designs, both digital ones and actual physical palettes made of eyeshadow, like the ones that she made. I'm not going to talk about my real world custom palettes in this episode. That one is its whole other world, and that demands its whole episode. I feel like it needs its own episode to get to the bottom of that one. But she was also the big inspiration for my real world custom palettes. But from what I remember, her custom palettes were all based on intellectual properties like Star Wars, Princess Peach, Yu-Gi-Oh! And I wanted to make similar palettes like that. I had a lot of different ideas swirling around in my head of different intellectual properties I wanted to make palettes off of, and not a lot of money to actually make custom palettes like hers. I did make one of them. I made the Custom Ever After High palette, which was a ColourPop build-your-own palette that I glued some printed-off images to. And that palette originated as a mock-up. It originated as a palette design, like one of the ones you'd see on my Instagram now. So that one did make it to reality, but a lot of my other ideas had to stay as ideas. But these custom palettes were really the basis of me making palette designs based on intellectual properties. So like the Gem palettes I made, the Doctor Who palette, all of Monster Mondays, that whole series, that all kind of spiraled from me watching these videos and being like, oh, I could do something like that. So, in the very tail end of 2019, I was going through a pretty uncertain period with my YouTube channel. I was uploading less, and I felt a lot more selective of the content I wanted to make. At this time, I was also noticing a new trend on Instagram. A few accounts were popping up on the Explore page of Instagram, and they were making the exact kind of designs that I'd been making this whole time. And that was something that really excited me. At first, I didn't post my designs, though I definitely considered it, because I felt like if people saw their designs and then they saw mine, they'd be like, why are you copying off them? Which, like, now I'm saying that, it sounds pretty asinine, which was the reason I eventually caved in and posted them. Like, nobody owns the format of designing their own palettes. Nobody on Instagram does. I certainly don't. Not even LS or Makeup Struggles or anyone I was inspired by. It's a format and a medium, and as long as you're not stealing people's ideas and concepts and designs, there isn't really a problem. And from where I was standing, my designs were actually pretty different from the other people who were doing this. I wasn't copying off anyone, and my designs were distinct. One of the accounts was more mainstream focused, another just did Jeffree Star palette designs. I definitely got to the point where I was like, okay, people might really enjoy my designs. People might really enjoy my perspective and what I can bring to the table, which is something a little different. So, with that newfound reasoning in mind, I decided just after New Year's to post one of my oldest designs, the Too Faced Dark Chocolate Bar palette. Then I posted some more designs, then some more, then some more, and then the whirlwind began. Later on in this episode, I'll be answering some of the questions that I received from my fabulous friends on Instagram. That's going to be like the very long closing section of the episode, but it just so happens that one of the questions I received ties into this next section. So the question I got was, what programs do you use to bring the palettes to life? And what's convenient is that I actually want to do a whole section about that, where I talk about how I make the palette designs from concept to creation. So we'll get to the question first. The programs I use to create the palette designs are Microsoft Paint and PowerPoint. And the vast majority of the time, those are all the programs I need. So I'll go into PowerPoint first to decide which of the layouts I'm working with. I have a whole like document which is just different layouts. Then I bring it into Paint, and this is where the fun really begins. Once I've settled on the concept or the idea or the reason for this palette to be a thing, then I go on to color selection. Often I'll bring in source images, particularly for anything involving an intellectual property like the Care Bears palette, or if I'm working with like a nature theme, I'll pick colors directly from images of scenery. However, sometimes I can just dive into the color widget on Paint and pick out some colors that I like the sound of. Then I'll pick out a few colors and pop them in, then fill the rest of the palette with shades that I feel go with them. If I want to alter the undertones, I can do that now or in PowerPoint later on. If I want to reorganize the shades, I can either bring in another image of the layout, or I can just reorganize them again in PowerPoint. It's quite a flexible process. But either way, after I've picked out all of the colors, I import the colors into PowerPoint. I used to actually copy the RGB codes for every shade and fill them in that way, but then I realized that if you use the little dropper tool on the fill feature, it does the exact same thing but way quicker. So you can bring in a screen grab of the Paint design and very quickly put them into the PowerPoint layouts, into the little shades on there. So next I focus on the packaging. What I do with the packaging is I take some source images, get some snazzy fonts and logos, and I just make the packaging unique to that palette. The PowerPoint picture effects are really useful for this, as I can take a source image and give it like a pixel effect or a paintbrush effect to give it a more stylized look. And that pretty much forms the foundation of any palette packaging I do. The other thing I do is font shopping. I love font shopping because I've always had a deep-rooted passion for fonts, which sounds silly, but goddammit, I was passionate. And that passion comes from a young age. So I still really enjoy going on free font sites and picking out some cool fonts that might look good on a palette as like the name or even the shade names. So once I've done the packaging, now the question arises, what about those metallic shades? The matte shades are usually just a solid color, but for the metallics, I have to add an extra step. This is one of the most fun steps, but also one where you have to make tough choices and nitpick your work a lot, so it can often be a bit of a difficult step too. Come along, y'all, we're going back to Paint. So, I take the design with the finished packaging into Paint and I make my final selections on which shades are going to be metallics. I say metallics, that could easily extend out to satins, shimmers, fold metallics, or duochromes. No press glitters though. I do not fuck with press glitters, even on my designs. Anything that's cute as a press glitter is almost certainly going to be cuter as a metallic. That's what's going to be engraved on my urn once I've died. So, once I've settled on those choices, I make a little patch of the eyeshadow colour, get a version of it that's lighter or brighter or has a certain flip, and use a spray brush over it to create the sparkle. After that, I just use the transparency widget to my advantage and play with some editing magic. That's code for this process is too boring to describe in an engaging way. So we're going to call it editing magic. And once I've done all of the shades I want as metallics, I get that new image and I bring it back into PowerPoint and then I format the design for release. So it's putting it in a cool layout and stuff. I know other palette designers use other programs, but for me, this combo just works fabulously. It's quite a flexible process, and it means that I can change things after I've quote-unquote finished a design. If I go back and think, no, that needs to be darker. Like, I can do that really easily. That happens a lot more often than you think. Like, the last Marc Jacobs palette I did, the Perfect palette, that had a lot of post-design edits. Some of my Natasha Denona designs have had, like, shades made metallics afterwards. The Meltful Steam palette had some shades made darker afterwards. It happens pretty frequently. And sometimes I'll even make the edits like the same day I'm putting it out, which is rare, but it does happen from time to time. It does. Alrighty, now we're going to go on to the most exciting part of this episode, which is the frequently asked questions zone. And the criteria for a question being a frequently asked question is very simple. And it is, somebody asked me this, like, once, because as far as I'm concerned, even if only one person gives a shit about a particular topic, that's enough of a justification to get me to answer it. These are all going to be anonymous, so I won't reveal who asked what. So if your question was answered today, that's your joy. That's your relief that your question was answered and the mystery has been solved. So the first question I got was this one. What comes first? The colours, the brands, the palette names, etc., or other inspirations? This one honestly changes like the weather. An obvious exception to this rule is if a palette is based on an intellectual property or an album, it'll start with that. But sometimes it'll start with the brand and the format. For example, a lot of my Natasha Denona palettes have had this nature theme going on. So if I want to do a new one, I'll go into it thinking, what would the next step be with this series? I might want to try out a new brand or layout, like when I did the Kaleidos designs. Those were literally just, what could Kaleidos do with the Futurism layout? And then I kept it within their more space-oriented theme. Same thing with the Dose of Colours palettes and the Huda Beauty Birthstone series that I've been doing. It's just kind of naturally evolving from the last one. And then my last big example would be the Naked Love palette that I did. Because that palette was actually more of a prediction of what Urban Decay could do next after the Naked Heat palette. I designed this palette before... Even before the Naked Cherry came out, so it came from that long ago, and I was just kind of debating on whether to even release it, and then I eventually did. So sometimes they spin off from real world palettes, and then sometimes they're just my random explorations. And then sometimes it's purely conceptual. One day I might be like, okay, I want to make a nautical themed palette, and that might fit into a couple of different brands. So then I go into evaluating which one it would work best for. I've seen a pattern for having a lot of the more fun stuff be Colourpop palettes and then having some more serious stuff as like Melt palettes. It's very interesting. Sometimes it comes from a thing like a flower or a subculture, sometimes a phrase like the OK Boomer palette did. It's very dependent on the situation at the time. Either way, whether it spawns from the brand or the concept, usually that's when the colours will start to be involved and where that side really comes into it. The next question is about my album series, the series I make based on like albums of music. When you do palette designs based on albums, how do you go about choosing the colours? That's a great question, and it has a couple of different answers depending on which shade. In every single one of these album palettes, there's going to be at least a few shades that are very specifically tied to a song from that album. For example, if we look at the Katy Perry Prism palette I did, that was one where I knew I wanted Walking on Air to be a bright periwinkle, and I knew that Unconditionally had to be a burgundy. Like, I just had that in my mind, and that kind of sets the foundation for the rest of it. Sometimes the palette is completely made like that, and it's based on a very weird and subjective song feeling. I don't have, like, sound-to-colour synesthesia, where I can see colours in music, so it's more of a what colour does the sound and the lyrics evoke in my mind, which is quite a subjective thing. And sometimes it doesn't even come from the song, it can come from the single cover or the music video. Like, in the Teenage Dream palette I did, the Blue California Girls shade, I specifically made that one blue because that's where I first remember the bright blue wig from. And often I'll build colour stories around those main shades that I can see fitting in with the album and with the vibe of it, if that makes sense. And those extra shades will get names that I feel suit them best based on the titles of other songs on the album. And even then, those palettes will go through versions and rearrangements and edits to get them right or change shade names midway through sometimes. But that's my main method for the album palettes. Right, on to the next question. What's your ideal palette format? Well, honestly, I'm pretty flexible with the palette formats I like, but there is generally a formula I prefer sticking with when I'm doing the designs. I usually like working with anywhere between 8 and 18 shades when I do a palette. The main exception to that rule is the Monster Monday series I do, which has 6, because I just feel like that works best for the individual characters. And I actually really like working with any of those different formats. I don't really have a preference or an ideal pick, like, in my mind. But one of the reasons I feel like that's the way it is because different concepts and ideas warrant different sizes. Some of the concepts have a versatility to them that means you can put them in a 12-pan or a 16-pan and it'll be great. But with others, if you put them in those sizes, they'd either be full of filler or just end up unfocused, so they'd work better in a 9-pan palette. Sometimes I'll even change the size midway through if I think, like, maybe this would work better as a palette with more or less shades in it. And one interesting observation I've found is that though I don't have a disdain for bigger palettes, and I think it's completely possible to design a bigger palette that is really exciting, for me, it's a lot harder to make a bigger palette unique and exciting. If you have a very focused and central color story, that's easier to do with a smaller size, but with a bigger size, you kind of have to broaden things out, otherwise you'll just end up with a ton of filler. But when you broaden things out, it can just end up like a rainbow palette or a load of random colors that don't really make sense. Now, I really went through this process when I made the Boudicca palette design, and I really love how that design turned out, but that's partially because I spent ages on it, and ages getting it right. I went through a whole other version of it that I had to scrap because it just felt so unfocused and repetitive. So I slept on it, and then I went back the next day to do another version, and that version did work, and I'm really proud of that one. So my final thesis on size is that it's harder to make a big palette unique. So technically size matters. Make of that what you will. The other thing I wanted to quickly allude to for this question, I'm sorry you're getting a whole section for this question, but I did want to talk a little bit about shape. Shaped palettes are fun. I think there's something enjoyable about them, and it brings a sense of whimsy to a product. But I also think it can be a very easy way to mask over certain issues. Like if a color story is random or unfocused or repetitive, it's easy for a brand to mask that over by shaping it like a pretzel or something. It's fun, but I ultimately feel like it's a case of style over substance. And I always want to aim to have the color scheme stand out on their own accord, not really be at the mercy of the shape. So 99% of the time I make rectangular or square palettes, and that's what I prefer to design. The one time I didn't do this was when I did the Spice Girls palette, and that was circular. Now, I really like that design because I think it worked with just the kit value of the palette, and it felt like a slice of each Spice Girl with their own background and arrangement. So that was my one exception. I did it for the Spice Girls and no one else. So one really interesting question I got was this. How do you connect the image you have in your mind to a real-life concept? And for that I say, reference images. There are times that I'll have an image in my mind of what a palette could look like, but most of the time, that image that I have in my mind is going to be really molded by reference images and things I find online. That's really the key element. Just going on mind thoughts is a pretty bad idea most of the time. If I did not use reference images and I just went with the stuff in my brain, a lot of the palettes would look weird and they just wouldn't work. But having those sources and points of references, especially for designs that involve like nature or something like coming from nature, it really bridges that gap between the concept in my head and the finished product on the screen. 10 out of 10, would recommend source images. We love source images here. And then another really interesting question I got, you guys did some great questions, by the way, was this one. Does color theory impact the palette design when working solely off an image? So bear in mind, this response might come across as like word vomit, because I'm not too familiar with the academic side of color theory, so my terminology might be a bit off. But yes, overall, I think color theory does have an impact on the palette design. When I design a palette, I'm usually combining reference and source images for different shades with a little bit of just what I think would work to round everything off. So little bits and pieces from in my head. And I find that I gravitate towards different gradients and arrangements. And I think subconsciously, color theory is a part of it. But it's one of those things that's like hiding in the cortex, I guess. That's a really weird way of putting it. But basically, I try my best to weed out any combos that I think would just clash and not go well together at all. So, short answer, yes. That was a very long-winded way of saying yes, so I apologize. I have to apologize. I feel like I'm running out of sentence starters, but another question I got was about makeup looks. So the question was, do you visualize makeup looks with every design? Yes and no. I never really think about specific looks that can be created with a palette design unless I'm duping it out within my own collection for duping the design, and that's like much later in terms of the palette's lifespan. And then I'll do two looks with the palette. But truth be told, when I'm actually designing them, I don't really visualize makeup looks in that way. That might sound like I'm throwing caution to the wind and just betting on the hope that these palettes will be able to have some looks done with them, but I like to think I have a fail-safe. I'll always make sure there are certain shades in a palette to make sure it's versatile. And I don't mean like an off-white and like a specific brown. I mean kind of shade archetypes. Like I'll try and have multiple depths of shades, different metallics, different starting shades. I never want to just be like, okay, here's your one transition shade and your one dark shade. So in order to ensure that there's capacity for multiple looks, I try and include multiple actors for those roles. It's a strange analogy, but it makes sense to me. So that acts as a way of ensuring that there will be a variety of looks, though I never visualize which specific looks there will be at the time. It hasn't tripped me up so far, so I feel like it's a reliable formula. Then again, I probably shouldn't jinx it. So the next two questions are quite similar, but I feel like they're different enough to have different answers. First of these two is this one. Is there a palette you've never posted because a shade or two has held you back? This is an interesting subject because most of the time I never scrap designs. I just leave them lying around for a while, and chances are, in a week or so, I'll have found a way to fix it, with one exception, which I'll talk about later. One big example of this was the Fondant Fancy palette design I did. I think it was a ColourPop palette. That one was stuck in development hell for the longest time, and it just wasn't working for me. I'd done the finished design, but I just had no real interest in releasing it because it was just so randomly put together. I just felt like it didn't go together right. So it just sat on my computer for weeks collecting dust. Now, this palette was originally a £9 palette, and it didn't have the column of matte warm neutrals on the left. It's kind of how it's structured. There's this column of just warm neutral mattes. And what I did to fix the design was rearrange the columns so I felt like they would make more sense, and then add that warm neutral column, which made it a £12 palette. And it all just clicked from there. The color choices felt a lot less random, it felt more connected and rounded off. And that took a while to happen, but I'm glad it did. So, what I do is that if a shade or two isn't working in a palette, I usually just put it at the very back of my release schedule, wait a week or two, and play around with it. And more often than not, I can find a way to rework it rather than scrapping it. Now, I did mention that there was one palette design. And this is only one palette design I've ever fully scrapped, at least as far as I can remember. And that leads me on to the other question I was talking about, which was, are there any designs you've scrapped because of the concept or execution? The one design that I scrapped was one that got scrapped at the very last minute. Like, I was literally writing the description on Instagram when I scrapped this. It was a Sugar Pill palette in their new pill-shaped format, which I think is such a cool format, and I wanted to work with that. And I still have the layout in my document, so I could still work with that in the future. But what I did is I decided to go down a darker route with it, and I made a palette called the Bitter Pill, and it was like the dark side of the pill. It was all a bit grungy and dilapidated in its color story. It was kind of like a little bit American Horror Story-ish, I think. And I felt like that worked at the time. But the problem was with the collective theme of it. All of the shade names were very medicinal themed. It was clinical but sinister. And when I was writing the description on Instagram, I looked at it and I realized, oh shit, this is a terrible idea. This is a palette with shades alluding to like viruses and vaccinations and whatnot. And you're releasing this now in a fucking global pandemic. Are you mad? Now, I sound pretty casual about it now, just like laughing and stuff, but back then I was really startled about it. So I immediately just erased the description, and then the design I was supposed to be posting tomorrow, well, the tomorrow that was then, I posted it then instead of the Bitterpill palette. And I did actually try and rework the design. I changed the shade names, I tried to take it in a different direction, but it just didn't work out, and I just wasn't happy with the overall execution, and it wasn't really a one or two shades thing. It was a all of it thing. So that palette never happened, and I'm not sure if I'll ever take another stab at it, but if I did, and if I did do it with that name, it would not go into that same like medical territory that the old one did. I'd steer clear of that. And that actually leads me very nicely into the next question. Are there any designs or brands that are off limits? I.e., brands that you won't design palettes for or concepts that you'll never do. I have a small mental list of stuff I'll never do, but I've never actually put it on paper or really talked about it. Mostly because it's pretty small and pretty insignificant. There's so much you can do with palette designs. There are so many different themes, so many different concepts and brands to play around with. It makes it very easy to not think about the off-limit stuff and just not, it doesn't even pass your mind, really. So, first off, personally, I can say I'll never make a Jeffree Star palette design. I won't. There are other accounts that do that and they do good stuff with those designs, but for me, I don't want to associate my work with that man. I don't want to take this world of like free creativity and fun designs and tie that into something so nasty and like everything I'm against in makeup. I think he represents all of the bile and the negativity in the beauty community, and I'd rather not have his brand as part of my designs. And that's really the only big exception I can think of, other than like, I don't know, Cookie Ann Cosmetics, which I don't even consider that a brand. I consider that a joke. But a year or so ago, I probably would have said Kat Von D as well as a brand I'd never make a design for. And now, obviously, that she sold the brand, that's changed my perspective a little bit. I think of that a little differently now. Now, I think there is a possibility that I could make a KVD vegan beauty design, but there are two things stopping me. One is, what would a KVD vegan beauty design even look like? Which, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I didn't know it like a couple of months ago, and I still don't know that now, even though they've released a new palette. Then the other thing is, would these designs even be needed? Which is more of a question of the brand's position in the makeup market. Like, a year ago, if I wanted to make a palette that went along the line of like a gothic makeup, it wouldn't necessarily need to be a Kat Von D palette. It could be a Melt palette, it could be a Lime Crime palette, it could even be an Urban Decay palette. I never felt the need to make a Kat Von D palette because it could easily that theme could easily go to any other brand. And honestly, a year on, I still don't feel a need to make a KVD vegan beauty palette, even without the owner being a part of it. With that, I can't really say never because there's a chance I might make a KVD vegan beauty design one day, unless someone came up to me and said, no, this would actually be a rather bad thing for you to do, and that would make me quite upset. But even if I wanted to do that kind of design, I don't see that coming very soon, to be honest. That might just be a far future thing. And then the other thing is theme and concept, which I also have a pretty straightforward ethos on. I said it once, but I think it bears repeating for this bit. You can do so much with palette designs, so many themes, color stories, concepts, images. And I think if you're itching to jump onto something controversial, you're really missing a lot of the actual valuable topics you could choose. I don't know if missing the forest for the trees is an appropriate idiom for this. It might be. But overall, I think making palettes that are intended to be controversial or offensive is such a cheap move, and I really don't like it. Now, I'm going to use a real-world example. There was an indie brand, I think they're still around. They did a palette like this, and it was all political buzz terms, and it was so obviously inflammatory, and I just really did not like it. The worst thing about that wasn't the product, but the way it was marketed, like, oh, this product isn't for all you triggered folks. And it's like, wow, way to insult a large portion of your audience that might be concerned with social justice and, just being a decent person. So, yeah, that's not happening. If you're making products to offend people, then I'll be honest, you probably don't care very much about creativity. And I'm not afraid to say that with my chest. If you want to create something that people will enjoy and create all these great looks and great ideas with, then that should be enough. And for me, that is enough. If you want to create something that just stirs the pot and creates drama, then chances are you'll get clicks from it, but it won't be successful on its own merit. It'll be successful because you make people upset. And getting success by making people upset is a pretty scummy way to get a following. I want my designs to be good because they inspire people in a positive way, in a way that sparks creativity and, I don't know, even makes people laugh. So I do all sorts of different themes with my palettes, like fruit, flowers, toy lines, gemstones, sharks, famous women in history, subjects that can provoke creativity and not outrage. The only time I think I've went political with one of my designs was the OK Boomer palette, which I think was a light touch take of the subject and I think quite a sympathetic take on the subject. And it wasn't intended to be inflammatory, as it was more of an observer stance. And I didn't receive any messages saying that it was like inflammatory, and I haven't heard any word about that. But I never want to make palettes that are intended to upset people or shock people. So you're not going to see an orgy palette or a porn palette or a graphic violence palette, because I don't want to do those. And I don't feel a need to do those. It's just unnecessary as far as I'm concerned. I'll stick with my pop music and my circus themes. Thank you very much. Now, I have a very special question from none other than my sister, who asked me, when are you going to design a palette solely revolving around your love for me? And I, for one, think that's a great idea. Narcissism the palette, coming soon to my Instagram. Honestly, I actually have quite a bit of credit to give to my sister. She was the one that suggested a couple of ideas for palettes, like the Dr. Seuss palette I recently came out with and the Y2K palette. We both have that creative energy, I think, and it's really beneficial to have someone around who you can bounce ideas off of and workshop stuff with. So I have to say, I'm really grateful for her help in all of this, and I do really value her as a person. Just not enough to make a palette about her. Sorry! You're not Dua Lipa. Come back with a critically acclaimed album and then we'll talk. And then my last question for today, which I think is a nice one to end it on, is which design are you most proud of and why? That's interesting, because I have a lot of palettes that I'm nostalgic about because of the designs, and then others where I'm proud of the reception it got. So we'll start with reception. That's probably the most straightforward one. I'm really proud of how well the Half Cousins palette did, because I feel like not only does the design hold up, at least I think it does, I think it's aged quite well, but it got such a good reaction from a ton of people, and getting to see both of the Half Cousins mention my palette and how much they liked it, that was such a moment for me, and I'm honestly still not over it. And then another design that I want to mention for reception is the Future Nostalgia palette. And I really love that design because it feels structurally unique and not really playing as much with an easy formula. But the big thing, and this is probably my claim to fame, is that I got a like for that palette from Melanie Fontana, who actually co-wrote one of the songs on that album. So for me, that was like a huge deal. That was something I'm still not over. But on design alone, I do have a couple of favorites. You say you can't have favorite children. I think that's rubbish. I think you can absolutely have favorite children. Like, the Spice Girls palette was something I was really proud of, the Pride of Peacocks design and the Citrus Blitz. The Halloween palette I made, wicked work, I really love that palette. The Marc Jacobs Lola palette, the Shark palette, the Alton Towers palette. Quite a few of the Melt designs I'm really proud of, and then the Natasha Denona designs. But I want to give a special shout out to the Jungle palette that I collaborated on with Julia K. March, because I still think that's one of my favourites from that line. And then the Y2K palette that my sister suggested, that turned out to be one of my favorites. And then more recently, the Rainbow High and Care Bears designs. I'm sorry, I probably sound like a massive showboat at this point, so I'm really sorry about that. But a little advice, often the ones I really love are the ones that get duped for the Duping the Design series on my Instagram. Though sometimes a few of them are too difficult to dupe in my collection, but that is a pretty frequent thing that does happen, so bear that in mind. Wow, so that was a lot of talking, but we finally made it to the end. We've done it. We've done the origin story, we've done the process of how it gets made, and even a healthy stream of answering questions. This has been a really great topic to talk about, because I got to look at what I do in a lot more of an introspective lens, like the behind the scenes, which is a lot of fun and quite refreshing. I only usually mention bits and pieces of the process, so consider this the whole story, which I'm very happy to be posting, finally. So thank you for sitting through this episode. I really want to thank you for that because I know I rabbit on a bit, but I definitely wanted this episode to be a deep dive into the topic. And I hope I've done that for you all today. And I hope that this was a sufficient, I don't want to say autopsy because it's still alive, it's still happening, but investigation into what I do. So, if you want to see these palette designs that I realize I'm not really able to show you because this podcast doesn't have a video, well, you can take a look at my Instagram at Ari Lynette, or you can follow the tag hashtag Ari Lynette Designs. That's hashtag ARYELYNETDesigns. I hope you know how to spell designs. And I may as well bring in my other social medias in this bit, my Twitter and my YouTube. They are both in the description of this episode as my Instagram. So if you are curious, then do check them out. And make sure you do subscribe or follow or click whatever button's nearby so you can keep up to date with my exploits. I upload new episodes on Saturdays, or at least I have the past 2 days. Let's hope I don't miss any out. Fingers crossed, y'all. And if you enjoy this episode, or you have something to say, or you want to ask me something, you can always message me on Instagram or on Twitter, or if there's a place around here to leave a review, then you know what to do. It's something you could try, especially if you haven't tried it before. It's surely a lot of fun leaving reviews. But whether you do that or not, thank you again for listening to this episode. I hope you had a good time with it. I certainly did. And remember, life is hard. But all you can do is try your best. See you next time.